Episode 4. How are we doing?
We're still here. Unbelievable. They haven't shut us off the airwaves. We're still broadcasting onto the internets. So, yay. All 15 of you who are listening, thank
you.
We thank you. 15 seems a bit high.
way to bring the tone up.
Yeah. thanks for that.
What are we drinking tonight? What did you get?
I am drinking a nitro milk stout.
That's correct, sir.
Yes. It's good. It's nice and smooth. I recommend.
I'm also having a stout, although it's not a milk stout. It is a Russian Imperial Stout, Old Rasputin. Google that Rasputin thing. It's pretty awesome.
Yes.
And it's by North Coast Brewing Company. I highly recommend it. The alcohol percentage is 9.
That's way high.
Which is particularly pleasant.
I think we can tell whose place we're recording by the percentage of alcohol. I wouldn't dare.
What about you, Simon?
I'm on a Kona Brewing Co. Big Wave Golden Ale, which has a really neat kind of West Coast retro label. And it's also pretty good.
Good stuff.
We do like our microbrews.
Yes.
This is kind of a fixture. At some point, we'll just run out of new beers to try.
That will be a sad day.
Yeah. There is some possibility that I may go back to England next spring, and I will bring back some British beer.
Awesome.
Do you have any particular ideas as to what that would be?
Bombardier.
Bombardier.
Assuming that Bombardier is still available, that was my tipple when I was over there, and I really enjoyed that. And it's available in the States, but you pay a premium.
Mm-hmm.
So we have arrivals and departures. The last time we recorded, almost at the same time, Governor Walker was getting out of the Republican race.
Mm-hmm.
Perry is already gone. John Boehner has now gone. And this afternoon, Arne Duncan has gone.
Mm.
Who's next?
Well, I can tell you that Ted Cruz is hoping to not be gone. He's been sending out a lot of emails, or at least his campaign has. Indicating that they need funds to keep going.
The FEC deadline was last night. That may be part of why.
That could be why. He's certainly wanting to stay in the race, but it doesn't seem like he necessarily has the oomph to keep going. So I'm worried about Ted Cruz dropping out, not because I was going to vote for him, but because I think he would have been one of the more fun candidates.
We know who's not going to leave, Ben Carson.
Right.
He's
posted like 20 million?
His interesting comments about Muslim presidents have really boosted his funding. So he's going to be around for a while. You know, it's one of those cycles where I'm worrying all of the candidates that appear to be more legitimate, quote-unquote, are dropping out. And the flavor of the month candidates are still staying around. Now it's early, but we normally have like one flavor of the month candidate, not two or three, depending on how you count.
Last time, Ed, it was the cavalcade of not Romneys.
Yes,
everyone agreed that we didn't want Mitt Romney, and we went through every other conceivable candidate. I find it really kind of sad that Vic Santorum thinks that he was the runner-up last time, when he simply happened to be the last not Mitt Romney standing.
Yeah,
you know, he happened to be the one who hadn't been processed through. And
he's like the last person besides the female lead in a Freddy Krueger movie to die. You know, I survived everyone else. I got the really big death scene at the end. You know, is this year the not Jeb Bush?
I don't understand who Jeb Bush thinks is going to vote for him. He obviously has a lot of money, but and this is the problem I have with a number of these candidates. I don't understand their rationale for being in the race. Who is it that they think is going to be voting for them, and what do they think that they bring to the race that other candidates don't? Ted Cruz, I think, thinks that Trump is going to, as you've said on previous podcasts, is going to hit reality and disintegrate on impact. Mm-hmm. And Cruz will soak up the Trump votes, or most of the Trump votes. So that's a strategy. It's not necessarily a great strategy. It's not necessarily a terrible strategy. But it makes sense. I understand the logic of who he thinks is going to vote for him. And I understand why he's in the race. I understand the issues that he thinks that he wants to address. I don't know what Jeb's answer to either of those questions is.
He wants to get into the family business, and you're going to vote for him because you guys are Republicans, and you will pull the trigger for him as opposed to Hillary Clinton.
If she's the nominee.
You think people are going to pull the trigger for Bernie Sanders over Jeb Bush? Like, if it was... I don't.
What about Joe Biden?
Yeah, I was going to say.
If it's Joe Biden, yeah, that messes everything up and screws everything out of whack. That's going to be an interesting campaign if Crazy Uncle Joe gets the nomination.
There have been articles today that basically said he's got to get in soon or not at all. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's still, as you say, it's very early in the cycle, and the basis for this was, well, if he doesn't get in soon, he's going to miss the deadline for the next debate. But who cares? I mean, what difference would that make? As Hillary might have put it.
Is it? I think NBC is hosting the DNC debate, and they told him there is an open seat for you. If you decide to run, you can come in. If you kind of decide to run, you can come in. Basically, please come in and take this seat because we'd like someone interesting and on the debate stage. And Joe Biden's guaranteed to say something interesting besides, you know, Bernie Sanders is going to say something interesting, but it's going to be about nationalizing the auto industry.
Are they backing him, or do they just want good TV?
Well, I think they're panicking because everyone else, the Republican Party, is getting great ratings. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they'd like a good TV. But I think you also have a ton of Democrats who are very, very worried that their nominee is going to get indicted. And as I said, you know, it doesn't look good on the debate stage if you walk on stage in an orange jumpsuit. Doesn't work.
That would be striking TV. I mean, Orange
wouldn't
is the New Black.
Wouldn't
that? That's fantastic ratings.
That is true. Yeah, that is true.
And this is the thing. Hillary is impervious. She would spin this.
Yes.
And, you know, if she's actually in jail, she would still be running for president.
She is empathizing with incarcerated Americans by being incarcerated herself, and she's going to introduce this totally new reform of the prison system as a result of her current incarceration.
Well, wouldn't that more be a result of the tough-on-crime laws that were passed under the previous Clinton regime?
Well, we all know that the previous Clinton regime apparently didn't happen. You know, the whole Defense of Marriage Act thing apparently totally wasn't signed by Bill Clinton.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. Absolutely.
The Atlantic and Politico both say that Rand Paul is next to go. Does that seem likely to you? They've got him on a death watch.
Yes. I don't see him moving up in the polls anytime soon. I don't know how deep his coffers are. And he's not pulling the fanatic support like his father did. Mm-hmm. He's just not doing that. You know, normally, you can count on the fanatics, but
this time there was Trump.
Yeah.
Well, if he can hang in till Trump gets out, will he and Cruz split the votes that went to his dad? Because my sense is a lot of the Trump base are the same kinds of people who voted for Ron Paul last time.
See, I think the Trump base is skewing older. The Trump base are people who don't follow politics. They're the mushy middle America greatness crowd. That's not Donald. That's not Ron Paul. I don't know where the Ron Paul free silver people have gone.
I do.
Where are they?
My guess is that they're going to continue to vote for whoever Ron Paul endorses in the Libertarian Party.
Makes sense.
I'd seriously doubt that they're going to do anything other than vote for Gary Johnson as Libertarian candidate.
Okay.
What if Rand Paul is the nominee and Ron Paul endorses him? Would that swing them over?
It would swing some. I don't think it would swing that many serious libertarians. There are a few positions that Rand Paul has that are really appealing to libertarians, particularly on the drug war, foreign policy and criminal justice reform. I'm not sure if those three issues are enough to swing a large swath of them. But even if it does swing only a little bit, it would be helpful, because we're talking about a pretty small percentage of the population as it is, and he can use all the edge he can get.
Mm-hmm. Am I right to think that Rand is the poster boy for Charles Cook's conservatarian idea?
I think that's who Charles Cook had in mind whenever he was writing that book. And one of the issues with writing a book like conservatarianism, and to be fair, I haven't read it yet. I need to read it. But what I find a lot of times with these books, occasionally you'll write a book and it's going to be timeless. But a lot of times you write one of these political commentary books and you're informed by what's been going on in the past 6 months, because that's what you do whenever you're a columnist. And looking at around whenever his book came out, looking at 6 months back from that, that's whenever Rand Paul's filibuster happened. That's whenever that whole his protest of the drone war happened. And so I think he was looking at that and saying, wow, there's a really big bump here. There's a niche, there's a need to talk about what's going on here, and it aligns with his political beliefs. So I think that's what he was going for with the Conservatarian Manifesto. Unfortunately, it hasn't panned out, at least not yet.
Arthur Brooks wrote a book at about the same time, the title is escaping me, but making a case for a kind of sunny, moderate republicanism. Same kind of thing there, and you think maybe with Jeb in mind?
I think
you're not talking about it's not a ghostwriting thing in the same way. I think it was Brent Bozzle who ghostwrote Conscience of a Conservative for Barry Goldwater, because Goldwater was already running.
Yes.
But these kind of books that lay the groundwork, and often they're written by the candidates themselves. And when Rick Perry, can't remember the name of it now, but he had a very good book shortly before he got into the race for president last time round. Although then he spent most of his time on the campaign trail running away from that book, to my great infuriation, because I liked a lot of what was in that book. But then he ran away from it.
I don't think that the Conservatarian Manifesto was written specifically to endorse Rand Paul, but I think it was with him in mind. And I guess the same thing could be said for the idea of the middle-of-the-road conservatism, but that's an older concept, or at least a more older mainstream concept, going back to Bush, and even before that, you know, the conservatives in the Republican Party have always had to try and deal with the Rockefeller Republicans and how to deal with stuff like that.
You were fairly, not enthusiastic necessarily, but well disposed towards Walker before the debates, and he didn't do terribly well, and he had a couple of bad interviews.
Yeah.
And now, of course, he's gone. You found a new candidate, and then Sam, have you settled on a candidate that you dislike least, other than Gary Johnson?
I haven't found a candidate that I like as well as Walker. I mean, Walker on paper looked pretty good. Whenever you do something, whenever you do the number crunching, if Walker could have delivered his state, which I had every reason to believe he could deliver his state, plus a few more states around that, then that's a key region. And him being a governor, him fighting the unions, having a name for that. So that's why I really liked Walker, because I thought he could deliver that region. The next person on my list, I guess, is Rubio, but it's one of those things where it's a big meh. You know, not because Rubio's doesn't sound impressive, but yeah, I mean, he's a senator. He's a young guy, and he'll get us Florida, maybe.
Florida's always dicey, isn't it?
Yeah. Florida's always dicey, and Florida's. It's going to be a toss-up. I just wish another governor would have had a stronger showing. Because, you know, my other governor that I was in favor of would have been Bobby Jindal.
Who's also on the Death Watch.
He's not going anywhere. He's done. If I had to guess the ticket, which probably means both of these candidates are going to withdraw within the next 2 weeks, it's going to be Rubio and then Carly Fiorina.
I saw something today, I think Marna Charon maybe, making a case for that, and I said the only thing that I don't like about that is the way round it is. It should be the other way around. I'd be happy with a Fiorina Rubio ticket. You know, we'll throw him a bone. You know, maybe when he grows up he can run for president. That kid's going to go places.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
I don't know.
Fiorina's fun. I like her.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. She's great. If she actually had won the office before, then, you know, I'd be more in favor of her candidacy. But, you know, I think that her loss actually taught her a lot of lessons. She definitely knows her stuff in terms of talking to the press and stuff like that.
David Brooks today said that part of her appeal is that she can do the quite aggressive style that the primary voters are wanting at the moment, while still being, in substance, fairly mainstream within current Republican thought.
Mm-hmm.
She is neither a George Pataki kind of person or a Ted Cruz kind of person, and kind of shoots straight down the middle while still capturing that kind of energy and zeitgeist.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really impressed. I'm sure you guys have seen the video of her being caught by that Planned Parenthood supporter. Mm-hmm. And the way that she handled that situation was just marvelous.
Yeah.
She was forceful, but she wasn't cruel.
Mm-hmm.
She's just masterful at that.
Yeah. And I honestly, you know, when people ask why I'm a Carly supporter, the answer is because she fits my prejudices for what a presidential candidate ought to look like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she speaks like how I think a politician ought to speak. You know, in complete sentences, which I realize is a low bar. But, you know, she seems to have thought about issues and have answers that don't sound canned. Even though, obviously, several of them are. But they get adapted very, very slickly. To a certain extent, there's no way to avoid that. If you're running for president, you're going to be asked the same questions over and over again. You're going to have to give a speech over and over again. Of course your answers are going to be pat to a certain extent. But being able to think on your feet rather than to just awkwardly jam your rhetoric into whatever situation it is, at very least at first blush, is a great asset for a politician.
If you were a casting director and you were casting a presidential candidate protagonist, you'd cast her mm-hmm. in that role.
Mm-hmm. Well, or John Huntsman. But look how that worked out for John Huntsman.
Yeah.
I mean, John Huntsman, remember, looked every year. And this was, I remember, the thing when I first moved here. People were fussing about, on the Democratic side, who looks like a presidential candidate. And John Kerry, John Kerry looks like a president. And, of course, he'd been awful. And ironically enough, we were just watching Governor Dean on
Morning Joe,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually does now conceivably look like a central casting idea of a president. You know, it only took 10 years. But you know, that doesn't always help. But I think I hope can picture Bernie Sanders as a candidate, sure, but not necessarily as a president.
Maybe if the United States of America had the word People's Republic in front of it, then we can picture that.
That's a nice little segue there, because speaking of the People's Republic, and speaking of comings and goings, Pope Francis just visited Cuba and the United States. Do you guys have anything to say about that?
I didn't pay attention to a lot of it, I'll be honest.
That seems like the best way to enjoy him, doesn't it?
Well, if I had met him, it would be different. If I had had the money, the time, and so forth, and anybody cared to give me a audience with the Pope, which they wouldn't, then I would have gone, and I would have said, Hola, Papa Francesco. ¿Cómo estás? We would have had a good time. You know, I would have greeted him in Spanish, because obviously that's what he speaks, primarily.
I have an alternative suggestion of what he primarily speaks, so I can't...
Right, you would prefer that he spoke Latin, I understand.
No, that's not where I was going, but...
That's the more charitable way to put it, yeah.
No, if I'd had the opportunity, I would have been happy to meet him and greet him, you know, like he was a long-lost uncle or something. You know, I have no problem with that. But I didn't have the money or the time, so I didn't bother going. And there was no particular reason to watch the media fawn over him.
Mm-hmm.
There was no particular reason to watch the pageantry. And there's no particular reason to really bang my head against the table as I watch a bunch of people who really don't care about the papacy or anything about the Catholic Church say, oh, how delightful all this is. Well, it just seemed like a really terrible show.
Mm-hmm. In the big scheme of things, in the picture that we're supposed to think of the papacy, the trip was... I'm not going to say completely pointless, but it was uninspiring. It had no real use. I thought some of the gifts that he presented to Fidel Castro had some points to them.
Yeah, and particularly the book, right?
Yeah, particularly the book written by a priest who was tortured by the Castro regime. That was a nice little... pointed gift to give to Fidel Castro. But overall, I mean, it's sad that a book is what I'm going to talk about as the highlight of the trip. You know, his speeches in the United States weren't forceful enough in terms of anything. I would have loved to hear him speak a little bit more forcefully about abortion. Heck, I would have loved to hear him speak a little bit more forcefully about a throwaway culture. He can bash us... Here I am getting defensive. But he can bash us all he wants from Rome, but whenever you come over here, if you're going to talk about our throwaway culture in Rome, why can't you talk about our throwaway culture in here? Why can't you call out our consumerism more explicitly here in the United States if that's such a big thing?
And I think it is.
Yes, yes. I do
honestly wish that he would have focused on that a lot. I think that's actually at the heart of the abortion issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is it your sense that he was uncomfortable coming to someone's house and taking a dump all over their living room? Or is it just a question of not being comfortable in English? Because I noticed his UN speech, with which I have a lot of problems, was a lot more coherent and a lot more forceful than the one that he did to Congress, but it was delivered in his native tongue.
I think his comfort level in English makes a difference, mm-hmm. because in English, he has to stick to the prepared remarks for the most part.
Yeah.
Whereas in Spanish, he can speak much more freely. And he often does, when he can speak in Spanish, pretty much toss away mm-hmm. the prepared yeah. remarks and just say whatever is on his mind. So, yes, I think the language is an issue for him.
I also wonder about his familiarity with the intricacies of American politics. Not that all popes should be intimately familiar with everything that's going on in America. It's a giant world out there. But, you know, his speech from in front of Congress was ghostwritten, as most papal speeches are. But it didn't feel like he really understood what's been going on in the United States, not recently, besides the fact that we have immigration issues, besides the fact that Obama is trying to push climate change agenda and he's trying to push climate change agenda, so yay, let's work on that. You know, besides those two things, it really feels like he didn't have a sense of the issues facing the church in the United States. And that's unfortunate, and I wish that would have been addressed a little bit more.
My sense of him is that he has much less use for ideas than Benedict did. I mean, you mentioned that papal speeches are ghostwritten, and of course that's true, and mm-hmm. Benedict used to ghostwrite John Paul's speeches and sometimes encyclicals. My sense when Benedict was Pope was that he paid much closer attention to the language, even if someone else ghosted the first draft. I cannot imagine a curial official ghostwriting one of Benedict's speeches and him not agreeing with every word, whereas with Francis you just get the sense that at best he doesn't care an awful lot about ideas, and at worst he's actively contemptuous. I mean, he referred mm-hmm. to us last year, and we'll talk about the synod in a minute, but you know, he referred contemptuously to us as the traditionalists and the intellectuals and our temptations. And, you know, I just remember Anne Barnhart talking about this at the time, saying, I'm waiting for the insult. You're going to call me a traditionalist and an intellectual. Well, I'm going to blush. You know, but that's not how he thinks. He's much more enamored by something else.
He's enamored by actions, which is great. But I think his contempt for ideas is unfortunately larger than his love for action. And the papacy is designed to act, but you act via ideas. The papacy is designed, you pull all of these levers, and these levers have to do with big concepts, with ideas, and the idea that one little motion has huge ramifications and it's going to be interpreted in different ways. And at the same time as having huge ramifications, it also takes a while to get things done. And that's not his personality. He's not suited to that.
Pagan Leo, right? Make a mess is what he wants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think that contempt is too strong a word, by the way. You know, when you hear him talk about ideologues, Charles Cook and Kevin Williamson talked about that on the podcast we listened to on the way back from Bloomington last time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that an ideologue is just someone who cares about and is motivated by ideas. And it is true to say that at the heart of our faith does not lie an idea, but lies a man.
Mm-hmm.
But the significance of that man is the ideas and truths that he confirmed are actually facts. Jesus would be a meaningless figure if he were merely a philosopher who had said some wise and important things. Or he would at least not be a terribly important person. And everyone says, or at least everyone who is not religious, says, well, you know, Jesus was a great philosopher and he said some important and meaningful things. And he really didn't. If you don't believe the truths that stand behind it, some of what he said is really quite jarring. It doesn't compare favorably to the pantheon of secularly acceptable philosophers.
Yeah. Like the Buddha, for example.
I was thinking of the Buddha, thinking of Plato and the Greeks, and so on.
Christ is no Aristotle.
Yeah.
And
he's also no Lao Tzu.
Yeah.
Or Epicurus. Even though Christians have, over the years, taken all kinds of valuable insights from these. I don't fault Thomas Merton for borrowing ideas and concepts from the East. I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I distinguish quite sharply between spirituality and religion. Those words, I think, are often used in a very amorphous and an ill-defined sense. And I had a post about a year ago defining them quite specifically. I mean, religion is about belief, whereas I would tend to think of spirituality as being about concrete practice and devotions and things like that. And so if you're appropriating devotionals and things like that from the East, those can, in some cases, be severed from, not all cases, but in some cases can be severed from the traditions that gave birth to them. it's kind of, you know, cultural vampirism, but if it works for you, sure, why not?
Yeah, one thing I noticed that the Buddha would have never said is, eat my flesh, drink my blood.
Yes.
You won't catch the Buddha saying that.
No.
No, you'll catch the Buddha saying that it's important to be a friend of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm. But you won't hear the Buddha saying, no one comes to the Buddha Father but through me.
Correct.
If such a hierarchy is even conceivable in Buddhism. No one comes to enlightenment but through me. Maybe that's a way to put it.
Sort of. In the Mahayana tradition, my understanding is that we all have a Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, yes, to become enlightened, we have to participate in that Buddha nature that we share with the Buddha. So in a sense, we do come to it through the Buddha, and we do that through his teachings. But not probably in the sense that Jesus meant it.
I say, how do they mean when you say that there's a bit of Buddha in all of us? What's meant by that? What would be a dummy summary that I can follow as someone who's not super familiar with Buddhism?
That's a little complicated.
I mean, what I guess I'm saying is, do they mean a piece of the Buddha as an idea, or do they mean a piece of the Buddha as in a more spiritual sense?
In a more spiritual sense.
Okay.
So we all have a capacity for enlightenment. We all have a capacity for the kind of loving kindness that the Buddha demonstrated after his enlightenment. We all have that capacity to transcend our own existence within the cycle of death and rebirth. We all have that.
Okay.
That's a simplistic way of looking at it, but yes, that's probably something you can hang on to. That's not too esoteric for a podcast.
I did find amusing that we had the Kim Davis freak out at the end of the visit.
Oh, that was beautiful. Back,
which I'm... Well, you thought it was beautiful, so you talk about it.
Well, apparently Kim Davis, the clerk who was jailed in Kentucky for not issuing same-sex marriage licenses, in case of whom
we spoke at length on the previous podcast.
In case you've been out of the country and under a rock for the past couple of months... apparently she met with the Pope, supposedly. It's looking like it was some sort of receiving line, and apparently, you know, everyone's freaking out about it. The conservatives are rather gleeful, the liberals are really distraught.
You could practically hear Father James Martin crying for
his
monitor.
Yes, I could. Well, what I wished it would have been more than what it was, because it's just so beautiful. I mean, to watch him make the same rationalizations that, you know, the National Catholic Register has been making...
It was one step removed from Kim Davis meets the Pope, 12 things to know and share.
Yes, 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 yes. That was pretty much it. And, you know, I love that Father Martin went after her religion, and, you know, why would she meet with the Pope, and what does her church think about this, and all of that, which I thought was rather interesting. And kind of low. And I mean, it's interesting because, you know, it's not like the Pope doesn't have a history of meeting with various apostolic Pentecostal groups.
Right, he does.
The Pope has a huge history of meeting with apostolic Pentecostal groups. It's not like he has a history of personally apologizing to them for things he has no business apologizing about. You know, and it's not like the Pope also doesn't have a history of not supporting same-sex marriage.
He met with a couple afterwards.
Well,
yes.
he met with
a former student.
Yeah,
his partner.
And met, not simply.
Where he actually had an audience with them.
He
yes.
didn't just met. Yes.
But at the same time, you know, he seems pretty clear that he doesn't think that same-sex marriage should be legal, and being the Pope and the traditional Catholic teachings on this is that because it's not moral at all, it also shouldn't be allowed by the state. which is always interesting. Of course the Pope's going to say that she should have the right to refuse.
That was what struck me as amusing. The latest iteration of the Vatican story about this is that they have underscored that the fact that he met / had a meeting / was simply in the same room with her should not be construed as an endorsement of her.
Mm-hmm.
No, it shouldn't be construed as an endorsement. What should be construed as an endorsement is his endorsement of her on the flight back, where he said, and I'm going to quote this because it's worth quoting, "I do not recall all specific cases of conscientious objection, but what I can say is that conscientious objection is a human right, and if a person does not allow others to be conscientious objectors, then they deny them a right." And this was in a context where he's specifically being asked whether government officials can refuse to issue those licenses. That sounds like an endorsement to me.
I can't wait to every time someone says, "Who am I to judge?"
Yes.
To pull that out. You know, "Who am I to judge?" Plop.
You could make a card game of that. You know, you pull it out of the community chest. Who am I to judge?
Well, but it's like playing war. You know, whenever the card game war, they pull out the jack and I pull out the king. Who am I to judge? Conscientious objection. Yeah.
Oh, we should really have a whole deck.
Yeah, deck of Francisisms.
Right. When I was in college the first time, when I got my English degree, I actually created a deck like that for arguments, for debates. I had a deck of debate cards where you could play particular kinds of cards in the debates. And we could probably do something similar.
That sounds like a fun game. Was it like full of different fallacies?
There were lots and lots of fallacies.
So whenever you play the card, did the person have to make that sort of argument?
No, the idea was that the card was itself the argument.
Oh.
In order to shorten the debates.
Okay.
So we were just being very honest about fallacies we were playing.
I'd like to get a system of, like in soccer, you have a yellow card and a red card. You know, you only have so many of them before you're sent off.
The question is hierarchy. Like, does the straw man beat an ad hominem? Does a reductio ad absurdum beat a straw man? You know, if you get four of a kind, do you win?
Those are all great questions. Yeah. I think we should answer those.
Yes, clearly. Yeah, look for the argument card game coming out in spring of 2016.
You could bring that into a broader framework. I have a checklist for controversial things that I work through. Whenever a controversial story comes out, I have how many items are on it? 11 items. And I keep adding to them because I always worry that I'm going to miss something. I'll show you later.
That sounds interesting.
What I've been trying to do is systematize and formalize what actually goes on in my head when I see things like the Kim Davis meets the Pope piece, because that was just so obviously an implausible story for just a whole host of reasons, including in the first round of reporting where the story was being reported from. And it was so obvious to me that the sources, once we were getting it, were not reliable sources. But I found it quite difficult to, when I've been pushed on this point in the past, to define exactly what I mean by a reliable source on anything more than an intuitive level. We have something in the show notes for another day. We'll come back to this. I'm trying to get that into a form that is a little bit more organized and thus comprehensible and defensible by normal human beings.
Were you surprised at how relatively plausible it turned out that she actually did meet with him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, so for those who don't follow this obsessively and who don't follow me on Facebook, I should say that that my position has been Pixar didn't happen. And by the way, you mentioned the gay couple who met with him, and the first thing that we see from that, Pix, it happened.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's still my position. Because what was claimed, and I realize that there's a lot of fine splitting of hairs in here, but we are talking about the religious order that gave us the adjective Jesuitical. So what was claimed was that Kim Davis had a meeting with the Pope. Now, as I understand it, the Apostolic Pentecostals believe that the Pope, if not personally, then ex officio, is the Antichrist. And so it seemed unlikely to me that she would want to meet with the Pope. Moreover, she lives in Kentucky, not D.C. or New York. But it turns out she was in town. So at that point, it became a little more plausible. Okay, maybe. But at the same time, why would she want to meet the Pope, and why would the Pope want to meet her? And of course, the obvious answer is the lawyers wanted to do so so that they could say, oh, look, the Pope supports Kim Davis entirely. She's not taking an unreasonable position.
Right, it makes sense for them to use his popularity in that regard, yes.
And it's not at all clear, but I think my erstwhile co-blogger, Pat, floated the receiving line theory. I want to say the night before it came out of that, and that seems to be exactly what happened, that this was a kind of a departing line thing where he was just going down the line, shaking people's hands, and then off he went. But yes, it was quite surprising to me when even to say that they met, in the same sense that I have met Hillary Clinton, rather than a meeting, that was quite surprising. And I would never say that I've met Hillary Clinton. The fact that I've shook her hand in a airport situation, to me, does not constitute having met, let alone having had a meeting with, which is what all of the press, led by the nose by the lawyers.
But what if Hillary Clinton blessed some rosary beads for you?
Or if she drank a glass of water and I took it and I blessed
my gosh, isn't that horrible? That guy should, like...
Cult of personality. This is poetry. It's disgusting. It's horrifying.
I don't know if it's... You know, the question is, would he have done that if it was Benedict?
And apparently he's done this before.
Yeah, so this guy's just nuts. And he's a Catholic, too. Yeah, quote-unquote. And here he is getting his kids to drink the Pope's backwash. Gosh.
If any of them are miraculously healed or miraculously made sick, maybe with, like, a strep.
They'll miraculously start speaking in Argentinian proverbs.
I'm not sure a strep or that would be worse.
So Francis has now departed to go back to Rome for the next phase of the synod on the family. And I should probably say, for those who don't know what's going on with this, or at least who are not familiar with the lingo here, so last spring, Francis had Walter Cardinal Casper, whose views on marriage, divorce, communion for people who are remarried, have been well known for 2, maybe 3 decades. This is not an unknown quantity. And he was asked to give by Francis to give a presentation on these matters to a assembly of cardinals. And unsurprisingly, he presented exactly what everyone would have expected him to present, which is what he has been saying for 2 or 3 decades. So he gave this speech, and Francis says, well, we're going to have an extraordinary synod in the fall of 2014, leading into the ordinary synod, which is now upon us in the fall of 2015. So the extraordinary synod that met last year was principally extraordinary because of the degree of chicanery engaged in, I would say. Yeah. Ed Penton has a book that doesn't argue that it was rigged, but produces a lot of evidence that it was, if not rigged, then something very close to it. My example here would be what in Catholic argot is called the interventions, speeches. So the Synod Fathers gave speeches in the first week, and this was all kept secret. This was not published. And then a midterm report, which was supposed to reflect those, was produced overnight, 5,700 words simultaneously translated into 5 languages, appeared, that was immediately denounced by a number of Synod Fathers as not in any way reflecting what actually happened in the first week. Father Fessio, who is the general editor of Ignatius Press, which published the Penton book, says that the mere publication of it makes it much less likely that we'll see the same kind of chicanery at the ordinary synod. Rorati Chaley, I think probably correctly, thinks last year was practice, and so this year they're going to be much better. And indeed, it seems like the ordinary synod on the family, the ordinary synod of bishops, which is about to meet, and which is much larger. It's in some senses easier to manipulate a large deliberative body because they are so unwieldy. The report is that there is already a committee writing its final report, even though it hasn't met yet. You think it's more likely that we'll see an honest and fair debate that in no way reflects the views of the hand-picked liberals such as Cardinal Casper, Gottfried, Cardinal Daniels, these people personally invited by Francis? How do you see this playing out?
If they try something like this again, I think we're going to see something that we haven't seen for several centuries, which is going to be fist flying in these meetings. I mean, let's not forget what happened last time during the whenever the midterm report was issued. Besides Synod Fathers coming up publicly and denouncing the report, there was reports of people banging on tables.
George Cardinal Pell.
Yeah, standing up and yelling and banging on tables. If they try this again, provided that they haven't completely stacked the entire synod, which I'm not
it's
aware that
to
yeah,
do
it's
that
harder
with
to
with
do.
The number of people and the ordinary synod has more people elected by people outside of the Vatican's direct control. But then on the other hand, Francis has handpicked various. So Cardinal Dolan is going.
Mm-hmm.
The lamentable Archbishop Supic is going.
Mm-hmm.
He has handpicked various people.
Mm-hmm.
But just numerically, they're not the largest contingency there.
Well, the good news, I think, is that Pope Francis has a propensity for selecting people at the margins and people outside of the usual European cabal.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether he likes it or not, if he follows through on that and picks people at the margins, more people from Africa, more people from Southeast Asia, Philippines,
Oceania.
We should
say, speaking of Africa, the Cardinal Napier was picked again.
Yes.
Handpicked by Francis, he wasn't elected.
Right. Yep. My guess is that if he follows through on that trend, then we'll actually have a good chance of a lot of pushback.
Mm-hmm.
That Cardinal Casper will face a great deal of opposition from precisely those people at the margins.
But if the speeches are secret, if the whole meeting is held in camera and it doesn't write any reports, and the only publicly available document at the end of it is Francis's speech summing up, quote unquote, what he feels has been the nature of the debate, would it even matter? I mean, is someone actually going to stand up and oppose Peter to his face?
We already have seen it happen.
I don't think we have.
Well, I mean, we've seen it as close to happen as could be before. The last time.
Are you talking about Powell objecting to the midterm?
Yeah.
I think that's the target of those. Here's one of the things that's interesting about that story. As Penton tells it, it was not just the Conservatives, if I can use that word.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I shouldn't, but it wasn't just the Conservatives who were angry about the announcement that all this was going to be kept secret, that the results of the Curculi Minores were going to be kept secret. And it wasn't just the Conservatives who wanted everything published, it was also the Casperite faction as well, people like Cardinal Marx, because they believe, I think, that it's all over and they've won. And it's only to their advantage to publish all of this additional stuff because this is feeding into what's about to happen now. And so the target of their ire for both Pell and Marx et al. Was not Francis, but Cardinal Balassieri, who is
mm-hmm.
the guy, quote-unquote, running the synod and, you know, seems to be running it in the most literal possible way. Dance, puppets, dance.
Well, I think that's what would happen. No one's going to come out and personally denounce Pope Francis. But they're going to find someone just under him who can be... Because Pope Francis isn't going to personally direct everything. But they're going to find someone just under him who is personally directing everything. And they'll go after that person.
Gotta cut that out.
Yeah.
Bing!
I thought my food was ready.
Yeah, the muffin's done.
McDonald's is going to do McMuffins for the day. I'm very excited. This is terribly exciting to me.
That is rather exciting. Yeah. Anything to get their sales back up.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see some of these revelations coming out, because we talked about this off mic last week, but there have been a steady trickle of revelations from people who certainly don't mean these as criticisms, who think that they are lauding their triumphal heroes. I'm thinking of Austin Ivory's book about Francis. I'm thinking about, I can't remember the name of the author, but there's an autobiography of the aforementioned Cardinal Danneels come out, and unintentionally, or not necessarily unintentionally, but without necessarily realizing the valence of what they're doing, they have revealed that there is a distinct faction that goes back at least into the 1990s that was opposed to John Paul II, that was certainly opposed to Benedict, that opposed Benedict's election. This is what Ivory calls Team Bergoglio. Several commentaries have suggested that they feel that they have won, that there's nothing that we can do to stop them, and so they are entirely brazen in terms of what they did last time out, and they're going to be all the more so this time, where there are even fewer opportunities for people to kind of jump in and exit the circuit breaker.
They can feel that they win if they ignore all the facts. The facts are that they're dying. The facts are that their churches are dying. No one's going to care what they think in 30 years, because they don't have any successors.
Are they not developing some now through revitalizing the more left-leaning part of the church? Or do you think those people just continue to kind of filter out?
I don't see the left-leaning part of the church being revitalized. Whatever accommodations that they make is going to be too little to sate the horrific appetites of the secular left. And that's who they need to attract if they want to revitalize their part of the church. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, how many members of the secular left are, or even the nominally religious left, are truly going to be interested in committing themselves to a life of being in the hierarchy?
You mean the male hierarchy?
All male, and they all wear funny hats. I don't know how much worse it could get,
it's
guys.
It's a bit of a sausage fest, really, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
The future of the church is in Africa. We're going to have, you know, we're going to have an African pope again pretty soon.
Cardinal Sarah, possibly.
Possibly.
Possibly Cardinal Napier. Though the one and only time I've actually argued with a cardinal was on social media. Cardinal Napier and I had a disagreement.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I still think he was wrong.
What were you guys arguing about? Do you remember?
Yes, he pointed out that that we shouldn't be worried about the synodal ambitions because it's going to be pastoral. And I pointed out to him that this is what we've been told about Vatican II for so long, that it was just a pastoral council, therefore it couldn't possibly have done any damage, right? we talked past each other a little after. We've been told this so many times that it's just not really that plausible. And it's the mutant hybrid of the argument that, well, the Pope hasn't changed any doctrine. But there have been a lot of pretty naff popes who haven't changed doctrine in the slightest. There are harmful things that the Pope can do other than changing doctrine. So even if the synod does it, I mean, even if the only thing that comes out of this are the motu proprios that you wrote about, that are just not going to work. They're not going to accomplish what they were set out to accomplish. They're at best going to cause some fragmentation, because I think the answer to your post is probably that the bishops who are inclined to align with Casper are going to tend to grant annulments much more easily, using the procedural mechanisms now available to them, and the people who are inclined to resist and go the other way are going to just turf it back to the more complicated status quo ante. And so what you start to see is the Anglicanization of the Catholic Church. It becomes less Catholic. Not in terms of doctrine, but in terms of it's more splintered, it's less uniform in how it does things.
The problem with that is you say it's the Anglicanization of the Catholic Church, but not in terms of doctrine. The problem with Anglicanism is that it's splintered in terms of doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that's one problem.
We've always had bishops around the world applying principles slightly differently, and sometimes extremely differently.
Well, and that's what subsidiarity anticipates.
Yeah, and that's the bishop's prerogative.
But I don't know that that's so in terms of what we would see is a disintegration of canon law in the same way that the job of the U.S. Supreme Court is to resolve circuit splits, because it is thought intolerable that federal law, which ought to be uniform, over the long haul should be interpreted one way in California and a different way in Georgia. That when the Ninth Circuit and the, kind of back myself into a corner now, I think the Fifth Circuit, I think that's wrong, maybe the 11th Circuit, I could forget, oh God, what circuit is Georgia in?
No!
Let's just say, let me back up and say, California and Virginia, when the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit disagree, the Supreme Court will step in and say, no, ERISA means this in California and the same thing in Virginia. And so I don't know that it's true that the bishops wildly differ in their interpretation of canon law, which is supposed to be universal between dioceses. They tend to be more split on pastoral things where there is room for disagreement.
Yeah.
Doctrine and canon law seem to be, we should be aspiring to be fairly uniform.
What about Eastern canon law?
That applies of its very nature only to the Eastern churches. It is.
Why not have a uniform code of canon law?
That's a good question. I don't know. I suppose because they are historically considered separate. Was there a code of Eastern canons prior to the creation of the 1983 code? Was the Pure Benedictine code? Was there a cognate of what is now the Eastern canons?
I don't know about that. What I do know is that the code of canon law for the East didn't exist in the same way that we think of a code of canon law for the West. Those were initially just canons that were sort of amalgamated from various councils and synods. There wasn't any sort of uniform document, typically for Eastern churches, in the way that there is in the West.
Well, we only got there in 1917. I mean, prior to 1917, what you're describing was canon law, period. It was just a mess. And that was the project of Benedict XV to get that whipped into some degree of shape.
Right. And that's a good project. I don't have a problem with that.
I found codification generally.
Well, I'm not necessarily a fan of codification, but of simplification.
Mm-hmm.
If we have a code of canon law, then it should be readily understandable in as much as you can make a code of canon law understandable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. You guys are reloading on the beer, huh?
Yes.
It's a Texas reload.
Okay.
You don't reload the beer you have, you just grab another.
Yep.
So, Mike, tell the audience about your new beer selection.
I have chosen the Founders All Day IPA Session Ale. It is very good. It is definitely an IPA. And
as always, no promotional considerations are received, but we will gladly receive them should they deign to send.
Please send free beer
to whatever we're calling.
Yes.
I think we have two things on the potential list at this point.
Yeah, yes. Tell us about your translation of a podcast.
Well, my homepage is in Latin, and so I needed to come up with a way of translating podcast. And there's no way to do it literally, because there's no way to translate iPod into Latin. And so Vox Catapulta was what I came up with, Voice Catapult. I really need to double check that that is how you form compound nouns in Latin, but my recollection is that that's right. And I think you would latch onto that, that was something that might be a good title. I still think that Audite, Hear Ye, is not bad. But we may be getting a little pretentious by having a Latin name for our podcast.
I think that would suit us well. But let us know what you think in the comments. Yes. If it should be Vox Catapulta or
Aldite. Or something else.
Or something else.
Yeah. I could come up with something really pretentious in Greek if you would prefer.
That's okay. We couldn't pronounce it.
we're Latins, not Greeks.
No, speak for yourselves.
I'd say after the synod, we may all be Greeks.
I have the feeling that I'm going to need another beer for that, too.
Yeah.
But what I'm drinking right now is quite seasonal. Not for the synod, but for this particular time of the year. It's the Hofbräu Oktoberfest. Very, very smooth lager. I am not a huge fan of lagers, and I have to say, this is one of the best lagers that I've ever had in my life.
So, in the first episode, we talked about Tinder. And by the way, I received some fantastic news because I walked away from that discussion thinking, boy, if I ever become a widower, I'm just screwed in this brave new world. But I was just reading today, the Wall Street Journal had a piece that said that what women are really looking for on dating sites is proper grammar. So, you know, I'm quits in here, mate. That's a win. That's a clear win.
Your entire About Me is going to be filled with about the Oxford comma.
Yeah. My profile picture will be H.W. Fowler. So, my question is, that why is it that the Casper stratagem doesn't go far enough? If we have to change doctrine on people who are divorced and remarried in order to reach those people where they live, why should we not also change our doctrines on fornication in order to reach Tinder people where they live?
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense to do that. I don't know what that would do financially for the German church, and that may be a concern of theirs. May not have quite the same benefits. But certainly in the post-Reformation Christian circles here in the U.S., that's already being done to an extent. There was a book being passed around some of my non-Catholic Christian friends, and they had a book about being single and saved and having sex. Previously, being saved and having sex outside of marriage would have been seen as very much an indication that you were not saved, and this seems to have been changing on the part of at least some post-Reformation Christian thinkers. And I think that makes a lot of sense if you're trying to get more people in the door, if you're trying to introduce people to Christ, to meet them where they are. And that, it's just a rational following of the logical path.
If the gold standard is what Jesus said, Jesus never said don't use Tinder.
Yeah, you notice that he never mentioned condoms either.
Right.
So, you know, he probably would have been cool with it.
I can answer.
We really have to throw up huge sarcasm flags.
Yes.
By the way, there's huge sarcasm.
Yes, please insert HTML sarcasm tags on that statement.
The thing is, there are plenty of fornicators who are receiving communion.
Yeah.
The entire reason why Casper and company is trying to push through the divorce and remarriage thing is because there's a very strong obstacle to that. Those people cannot receive, that can't be absolved while they're still in that state, at least under normal circumstances. Whereas being a fornicator isn't a permanent state until something else is resolved. You can have that absolved every time you go to confession. And so the priest doesn't have to ask. Whenever giving communion, the priest can assume, even if the priest knows you're a fornicator, the priest can give you communion because maybe you went to confession. And quite frankly, people receive communion even being fornicators because everyone received communion, you know?
Do you agree that that's something that we have to break? I noticed that, and I think that it goes to the thing of, well, everyone come up and cross your hands and receive a blessing, which I think was probably done so that people didn't feel bad if they weren't able to receive communion. I think that's a horrible thing, way to go about things.
I think your cause and effect is off there. I think everyone started to receive communion first. And then, because whenever I was younger, there wasn't the cross yourself and go up to receive the blessings. That really didn't start. I didn't see that common until probably the late 90s. I can tell you that everyone was receiving communion whenever I was a child. I don't remember anyone never receiving communion whenever I was a child. And we didn't do that whenever we didn't have the cross your arms to receive a blessing whenever I was in Louisiana. So that's a recent thing. That being said, I'd have to say that at least here at St. Joseph's, I've seen a bit of a trend of people not necessarily receiving communion, which we all want people to, if they are able to, receive communion as often as possible, but it's very good to be mindful about whether or not you're able to. We do a wonderful thing at St. Joe's where we tell people if you're not Catholic or if you're not able to receive communion, you may come up and receive a blessing. And just having that announcement has done wonders in getting people to come up and receive a blessing and getting people who are Catholic not to receive communion if they're not in the state to receive.
Yeah, I'm still not happy about that, but I think that's much better than how it was. My sense is that I'm in a very small minority of people who often keep their pew. But better that they're going up and just receiving a blessing. Because if in doubt,
yes.
You know, the cost of a false positive is potentially ruinous, because it's not something that you're then going to seek absolution for, of the nature of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said about just staying in your pew, but it's not the mood of the times.
It really surprises and confuses and even flummoxes the ushers. If you're in a parish that uses ushers, they don't know quite what to do with you. They'll kind of tap you on the back and stay put, and then they'll kind of tap more insistently. Yeah, I'm all right. And I was in one place where they tapped a third time and whispered, "We're going up for communion now." Like, thanks. Bye-bye.
Have fun.
Yeah.
Congratulations on not getting the hint.
Yes.
Which, by the way, wasn't the worst experience I've had of someone not getting the hint. I was at an Episcopal parish last year, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to stay for the whole thing, and I figured that when they went up for communion, since everyone was in motion, that was a good time to just slip out unnoticed, because everyone's already in motion. And I was physically chased out of the building by an usher who was insisting, "Oh, it's okay, you can come and receive communion if you'd like. You know, are you okay?" It's like, you got to take the hint.
Well, they're very desperate.
Yes.
Well, it's understandable that they are.
Yeah.
And then their churches are literally and figuratively dying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the demographics are fatal. And my impression experientially is that it is no different to what the statistics say. If you go to St. Stephen's, I mean, it's a nice church and they're good people, but they are thin on the ground. They're still doing the Anglican liturgy pretty well, you know. I'd like to see it become an ordinary parish, but that might be a bridge too far.
Well, I think a few things are going to happen for the Episcopalians. I think you'll see the serious Episcopalians go Lutheran. Or Catholic, maybe even Eastern Orthodox in a few cases. What I think the rest of them will do is go to a non-denominational church.
Well, interestingly, the low church Episcopalians tend to be the ones who are more religiously fervent, the ones who are more aligned with the evangelicals. Maybe not so much in America, I don't know about that, but certainly in Britain, when you think about the Reverend Nicky and his Alpha course, you know, they are what. And this is in no way a pejorative. If you're playing golf, a low score is a good thing. But they are much more aligned with what over here we would think of as mega churches. And they are not for nothing called evangelicals. It's kind of an odd inversion that in the Catholic Church, the people who are serious about doctrine tend to be high church in terms of liturgy. And it's the other way around over there. So some of them will filter out. whereas the people who are more habitual Anglicans, I suspect, will simply drift out as the price of identifying as a Christian gets higher.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that in the... Because to me, that's the inversion. To me, the inversion being high church, but not caring about doctrine, not being religiously fervent, that's the inversion.
Yeah, I find it very strange. Why do you think that is? I don't know. I have found it very hard to understand. I don't know. It's a great question.
I can tender a theory there.
Yeah.
At least some of the people that I've spoken to who like the high church stuff in terms of the forms of the liturgy, but don't particularly agree with all the doctrines, often find a great deal of comfort in the ritual. They often find a great deal of stability in the ritual. And I suppose in some sense you have to find some kind of stability in a religion.
Mm-hmm.
And some appreciation, doubtless, for the
beauty.
Sense of the art. Yes, the beauty of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it makes sense to me that if they wouldn't find stability in the doctrine, they would have to find it in the beauty, in the comfort of the ritual. I think the liturgy does a good job of responding to certain kinds of human psychological needs, regardless of whether you believe in the truth of the doctrines. And so it makes some sense to me that if those human needs are being met, and you don't really care about the truth of the doctrines, or you can deal with the fact that you don't agree with the doctrines, then you would stay for that.
And when it's done right, liturgy points towards what our 12-step friends would call a higher power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the problems I have with the way that the Novus Ordo is ordinarily celebrated now is that it precisely does not do that, that it's very much a closed circle. And I have the same problem, unsurprisingly, with the low church evangelical wing in the Church of England. But yet, when it's done right, the high church liturgy, whatever else it is, points to something transcendent, something separate. It's something that is removed from the common experience of the world.
Right, and I think that's entirely palatable to people of that particular mindset, because you're just talking about something.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything particularly specific. It's not anything that they have to evaluate in terms of their ideology. There's just a transcendent something, and it's all very comforting.
I wonder.
It's all very beautiful.
I wonder if there's a socio-economic aspect to it, especially in Anglicanism, with, you know, the more wealthy families being traditionally associated with the high church. And generally, if you are more wealthy, you're more likely to be more liberal and so more lax on doctrine, whereas a low church evangelical movements are generally more a people's movement type thing. Pull in the lower middle class, and those types of people are more likely to be more fervent.
It's a question that interests me a great deal. I feel like I don't have a good answer to give you, but I don't take that to mean that I'm not interested. I just don't have
mm-hmm.
a good answer.
Yeah.
If this were Hello Internet, this is the point where we would say, leave us some comments in the Reddit, and we'd love to hear what you say. And we're not popular enough to get away with that. But I would love to hear comments on this point, particularly from Episcopalians. I'd
yes.
love to know more
yes.
about this. My mom, maybe I have something to
yeah.
chip in.
Send us angry emails.
Send us
please.
Angry emails. But send us emails that are not just angry. You know, call us fools and knaves, but then go on to explain why we're wrong. I'm not saying you can't call us names, just
yeah.
get to the point somewhere in the email.
Be at least be creative in your use of expletives.
Yes.
Please.
Yes. All right. I think we'll call it a night then.